Okay, now we might need to put a little bit of light on in the main room for this one, because what we're going to do is going to have a reading from the Bible. Now, you've actually got a copy of part of the Bible in your hand. It's this one that says Luke on the front of it. So I'm going to invite now Michelle to come up, and she's going to read to us. And as she does, she'll tell us where we're going to be finding it. So don't worry about finding it, she'll tell us which page and so on. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi. Yeah, so if you'd like to take up your Luke's Gospel, then just turn to the first page where it says Luke. And I'm just going to read to us now the first paragraph there. It's also on the screen as well. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. With this in mind, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught.
Thank you, Michelle, very much indeed. Sometime in the 19... I hope you enjoyed your conversation, by the way, and I hope what we discuss now is helpful for you. Sometime in the 1930s, three youths apparently hopped onto a bus in Detroit, in America, and they tried to pick a fight with a man who was sitting quietly at the back. And they began with this mild insult, but he didn't make any response, so they decided to turn up the heat and began to abuse him really quite rudely, but still, the man said nothing. When they eventually came to the man's stop, he got up, and the youth realised he was a lot bigger than they at first thought. And he walked up to them, he reached into his pocket, and he pulled out a business card, and he gave it to them, got off the bus. They huddled together, and this is what the business card read. So what had happened is that they'd come face to face with Joe Lewis, who was become the heavyweight champion of the world from 1937 to 1949. And you could almost say that they actually stood in the presence of greatness, but they didn't recognise it. And I think it's fair to say that for centuries in this country, millions of people have believed that Jesus Christ was the greatest person who ever lived. Someone who'd actually transformed their lives. But over the last 100 years, at least the last 100 years, probably more than that, there's been a growing number of people who've been seeking to pick a fight with that idea and have been trying to discredit the person of Jesus, who he is, that he even existed, and really to convince us that we don't really stand in the presence of greatness. Some of those fighters have been more fictional than factual. So just think of Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code, that conspiracy that the church was hiding the real Jesus, who actually was just a normal bloke who married Mary Magdalene, and you can still find his descendants living in France today. Some fighters have been much more heavyweight, to think of Professor Richard Dawkins, the God delusion, but the consistent accusation is because we cannot trust the Bible, we cannot therefore trust Jesus, or what's said about Jesus. That the Gospels are somehow a myth, that they're an exaggeration, that they are now, as we know it, historically unreliable, culturally dated, and personally irrelevant. In fact, I don't even know why I came this evening. Why did you come this evening? It may be that for you this is an intellectual objection. This is a knockdown argument. If I can say that the Bible, and particularly the New Testament about Jesus, is unreliable, then that's end of the game. It may be for you, though, that it might be more personal. You might have been impressed with a Christian friend and just find yourself wondering, well, could there actually be anything in it? It may be that you grew up with the stories of Jesus, and as a child, with wide-eyed naivety, you thought, this is amazing. And as you've grown up and Life has become challenging, at times really difficult, as it is for all of us. And you thought, well, I'm not sure if I can really believe this. Can I really be certain? Well, the question is, what if you could? What if the Bible really is reliable? And not just reliable, that in it God has something so profound to say to each of us, as I mentioned earlier, that it will actually impact the well-being of our lives and our eternities. Wouldn't it be tragic, actually, to stand in the presence of greatness but miss it? So what we're going to do over the next 5 nights, and we do really hope that if you enjoy tonight, you'll come back. We're going to take a fresh look at Jesus' business card. Not the Jesus of our childhood, necessarily, or the Jesus of our tradition or our imagination, but as we find him in the original source documents, the Jesus of the Bible. And so tonight what we're going to do, we're going to address the most basic fundamental question. I put it into two parts, actually. The question is, can we be certain that what the New Testament teaches actually happened? Now, you might think, well, why aren't I tackling the whole Bible? Well, partly time, and partly because the Old Testament looks forward to Jesus. So once we become clearer in our understanding about who Jesus is, as the New Testament presents him, and the way that he understands the Old Testament, we are in a better position to start understanding the Old Testament. It points forward to him. But it is primarily a time issue for me this evening. So we're going to ask the history question, and then we're going to ask the personal question, does it matter? Does that sound fair? Good. You can interact. Fantastic. I've got to confess that at school, history was about exciting as Monday's lunch of dry liver and semolina pudding. With jam. Apparently, though, historians are amazed that Jesus who was unknown outside of first century Palestine should appear at all in any external ancient historical documents, and yet time and time again he does. He's referred to. So let me just give you a few examples that should come up. Hopefully. There it is. And he appears time and again among Greek, Roman and Jewish writers, most of whom were opposed to Christianity. That's fascinating, isn't it? So AD 55, the Greek historian Phallus, who I've labelled up there, described the death of Jesus, and he said the darkness coincided with the crucifixion with the one called Jesus. And he just said, well, it was an eclipse. Nothing superstitious, just an eclipse. AD 64, the Roman historian Tacitus scathingly described Christianity as that deadly superstition. In AD 70, the Stoic philosopher Mara Bar Serapion, known as Mars Bar to his mum, wrote in a letter to his son that Jesus was a king, a teacher, like the Greek martyrs Pythagoras and Sophocles. In the 2nd century, the Greek satirist Lucian wrote in a book, The Death of Peregrine, and very mockingly, that Christians took Jesus for a god and accepted his laws. And then finally, the Jewish historian Flavius Josephus described Jesus as a wise man and a doer of wonderful deeds, and wrote about the martyrdom of Jesus' brother called James. And it goes on, actually. We've got someone called Celsus, Suetonius, Pliny the Younger, the Talmud. And now, what we see from this is, we can't hang too much on this, but we begin to get an outline about Jesus, that he existed. His name, the nature of his birth, his family, his teaching, his miracles, his death, his followers' claims that he was God, the movement that flourished afterwards. That is fascinating, isn't it? Therefore, Jesus lived. But for the detail, we need to turn to the most important source documents, the New Testament Gospels. And actually, I think this is where the gloves come off and it turns into a bit of a bare-knuckle fight. This is Richard Dawkins in The God Delusion. Ever since the 19th century, scholarly theologians have made an overwhelming case that the Gospels are not reliable accounts of what happened in the history of the real world. All were written long after the death of Jesus. All were then copied and recopied through many different Chinese whispers generations. The four Gospels that made it into the official canon, so that's the canon of the Bible, were chosen more or less arbitrarily. Nobody knows who the four evangelists were, for they almost certainly never met Jesus personally. You hear that? The gloves are off. But the consistent assertion, really, of the gospel writers is actually the very opposite. Let me just show you an example. Here's an example from John's epistle. I've included the Greek translation there. And let me just read this to us. John writes, "That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked at and our hands have touched, this we proclaim concerning the word of life. For life appeared, we've seen it and testified to it. And we proclaim to you the eternal life, which was with the Father and has appeared to us." Now, you can't read that without thinking immediately. John is going out of his way to underline for his readers the historical reliability of what happened, because he met Jesus. He was there. He was an ear, eye, hand witness. And that is incredibly powerful, isn't it? So just think about this for a moment. It's just a thought exercise. Do you remember where you were, if you're old enough, at 9/11, when the Twin Towers were attacked? You put your hands up if you remember where you were at that. That's quite amazing, isn't it? That's quite amazing. Now, keep your hands up. So can you tell us where you were?
I was at work, at school.
At work, at school? Someone else tell us where they were? Corroboration. Greg?
I was at work.
Oh, sorry. At work?
Yeah.
Walking down Cannon Street.
Walking down Cannon Street. I was on the golf course. Imagine though that I went to New York and called a collection of the citizens together who were there on that day and said, "Look, my name is Zayla and I live in the UK and I watched the Twin Towers collapse on that day, all those years ago. But I want to tell you what really happened." So what really happened was the planes were hijacked, they took off. But before they hit those towers, they were diverted and they landed safely. And the towers, well, it was actually just a dreadful accident. It was a structural problem. What would they say? They would be outraged, wouldn't they? Wouldn't they say, "But we were there. We heard the cries. We saw the planes crash into the towers. We touched the hot twisted metal. We were there." And John says, "I heard, I saw, I touched. Please don't tell me that I wasn't there when I was. I was there at the most extraordinary moment in history." Now we might say, okay, well, perhaps he was there. But nevertheless, is it possible that what he saw was then changed? So he might have seen it, but what we hear now is actually not what he originally saw. Well, Luke, which Michelle read for us very helpfully, is very, very helpful. If you've got a little gospel open and you can see in the dim, dark, don't worry if you can't. Do have that open. Luke chapter 1, because he answers this so helpfully. Now let me just give you a little intro to Luke. Okay, Luke was a medic, he was a doctor, an educated man. That little introduction is written in high class Greek to a high ranking official called Theophilus. He wasn't an eyewitness. He wasn't an eyewitness, but he took his research from someone who was, the Apostle Paul, who he travelled with extensively. And he wrote this gospel about 30 years after Jesus. And I just want to pull out for you a few points. And just to help us, which I hope you'll find stimulating. I just need to trust this, but there we go. Here's the first one. Jesus' life was eyewitnessed, then handed down. So can you just see there what it says? "Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word." So what Luke says is that, look, I'm not the first one. Many have attempted to write about things that have been fulfilled. Now, we're going to come back to that a bit later, but it basically at this stage says, he's describing the extraordinary life of Jesus as a fulfillment of something that God had promised for a very long time. But also just notice in line 2, verse 2, that what they wrote depended on what the eyewitnesses handed down. Now, this year, as you'll know, we're marking the centenary of the start of World War I. and actually commemorating all wars. I don't know if you know this this incredible story of about 70 years ago, Witold Pilecki was a Polish resistance fighter in the Second World War, and he's the only one, as far as I know, who volunteered to give up his freedom and to go into the concentration camp Auschwitz. And against all advice, he wanted to go in so he could send out reports of Hitler's death camp. And he went there, he got himself arrested, he went to Auschwitz, he was there for 2.5 years, and he secretly sent out these reports. You can even read about them now, you can buy a book by him. But it was at great personal cost and extreme suffering. But it was incredibly brave and incredibly important. Now, would we really expect such a story as that to be forgotten? Just think about it. Would we really expect such a sacrifice to happen and for no one to bother to pass it on? Of course we wouldn't. What are the greatest of all stories? Think of the disciples of Jesus. They stood together on that flood, that deck flooded with water, as they heard Jesus saying to the storm, "Be still." They saw him take the hand of a 12-year-old girl and say to her little girl, she had died, "Little girl, I tell you, get up." And she did. And they heard him say that he would be betrayed and he would suffer and he would die and he would rise on the third day. And they were there and they saw him, and some of them touched those wounds in his hands, and their lives were flooded with joy and they were changed. Can we really expect them not to bother to pass on the greatest event in all of history? Can we really expect that? We might think, and Luke says that's exactly what happens, but we might think, well, why record it 30 years after Jesus? In fact, Paul was actually writing probably around 15 years before that. But even so, I mean, 15 years is a long time, isn't it? People's memories fade and time for stuff to get exaggerated and turned into a myth. But we need to understand the culture. Since the invention of the printing press in the 15th century, we've increasingly and perhaps more rapidly become a literary culture. So everything now is written down. Everything now is emailed, texted, blogged, tweeted, whatever it is. But before that, especially in the first century, it was an oral culture, A-U-R-A-L. Knowledge really came from hearing, not reading, and an awful lot of people were illiterate. And what the Jewish community needed were teachers who would employ centuries-old techniques of verbal transmission and memorization to formally learn over and over again the scriptures, what God had taught. So there's a great example of this. The third century Jewish Mishnah is a written record that was written to preserve the memories of 150 rabbis who lived between 50 BC and 200 AD. Mishnah just means repetition. You see that? It was an oral culture, unlike ours. We see a bit of that today, though. So we're just going to play a little game now. What we're going to do, I'm going to play a piece of music for you. I'm taking a cultural risk when I chose this. But I'm going to play this piece of music. And I want you to listen to the first line of the song and then work out if you know what the next line is. But don't say anything, okay? Just put your hand up if you know it, okay? You ready? Ben, whenever... We struggled with this a bit earlier. Let's see if it works. Hey, okay. Now put your hand up if you know. If you think you know what comes next. So, like, can you tell us what comes next?
Take a sad song and make it better.
Fantastic. Well, let's just listen. Let's play it again.
Hey, Jude, don't make it better. Take a sad song and make it better.
Okay, brilliant, stop there. We'll start getting the lighters out and get carried away. See, now, that was written way back in the 60s. So I was born in 66, that was written in 68, so 40 something, 50 years ago. And we remember it. We've been taught it. Do you see what I mean? So even in our literary culture, we can pick up things by hearing them and through repetition learning them. And so how much more in that culture? So look what Luke is saying is, he says, the eyewitnesses saw Jesus carefully passed on what they had seen about the gospel. Let's move on a bit more speedily now. And here's the next thing just to notice, that Jesus' witness life was investigated, then written down. So it was passed down, and then it was written down. So just have a quick look with me, would you, if you can see it on, it's up on the screen. Verse 3, therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so you may know the certainty of the things that you have been taught. So as the message of Jesus spread rapidly, and it did, through the Mediterranean and into Europe, of course the apostles, the original eyewitnesses, couldn't be everywhere at once. And it became apparent, fairly rapidly, that the gospel needs to be recorded and preserved. And Luke, this doctor, set about with medical precision, carefully investigating those eyewitness accounts. And he says he started actually much earlier. He says there, can you see, since the beginning. And as he travelled with Paul, he got that information. And everything in his gospel, if you were to read it, which I really hope you will, everything speaks of the careful observer. So he records details like, who reigned, King Herod of Judea in verse 5, Caesar Augustus and his censors in chapter 2, verse 1. He records more personal details about Mary, the mother of Jesus, than any other gospel writer. It's as if he met her and interviewed her. He knows the culture, he knows the village names, the names of hills, the names of trees like the sycamore. He knows so much, it's almost impossible to imagine how he could get that unless he spent a lot of time researching. So what we have here is an orderly account within one generation of Jesus, written with one generation. That is very close. And certainly in the lifetime of those who knew Jesus and could protest if Luke manipulated their witness. That, for me, has integrity. And it was safeguarded. So in AD 48 or around then, the Apostle Paul writes a letter to some churches in Galatia and warns them to be careful, because already another gospel that's distorted the news about Jesus has come onto the scene. And he says, be careful not to listen to that. That, to me, has integrity. And then in the second and third centuries, other gospel writers suddenly appeared from nowhere. And they claim to be written by famous people like Thomas and Pilate and Mary Magdalene. But when the canon of scripture was put together in the second and third centuries, those gospels were rejected, but not arbitrarily, as Professor Dawkins says. They were rejected because the supposed authors weren't really the authors. These were written 100 years plus after the life of Jesus. They contradicted the original eyewitness accounts. They were not an original source and not a reliable source. That has integrity. Can you see that? And whenever historians are trying to build up a picture of what really happened all those years ago, the first thing they do is they try to work out how many different sources there are. And the more there are, the more likely and reliable the events are. It's called the criterion of multiple attestation. So if they independently offer roughly the same portrait of that historical event, that portrait takes on greater feasibility. So there are around 24,000 New Testament documents, manuscripts, the oldest bit dating back to the 2nd century. And as the Gospels spread, they were translated into Greek and Aramaic and Latin and Syriac and Coptic. But do these, as they pulled in together, do they essentially say the same thing? Yes, they do, with negligible differences. That can only mean two things. Either, first of all, there was a worldwide conspiracy between people who had never met each other to lie about Jesus. Or they were carefully copied from the same reliable source. And that's really the conclusion. The Bible takes us towards, Luke says, so you can be certain of the things that you've been taught. Now, that may raise all kinds of other questions for you. But I hope at least you've begun to see the case that the Bible and the New Testament is credible, historically reliable. But what about the personal question? Is it even worth reading the Bible? Absolutely. Absolutely. Most of you will know perhaps not in person, but the author, Philip Pullman. And when he was receiving a prize, I can't remember when it was, in the 90s at some point, he said this. He said, "Thou shalt not is soon forgotten, but once upon a time lasts forever." What he was saying was that the stories are powerful. And I get that. I understand that. So I go to the cinema and I get wrapped up in a really good film, or, you know, Downton Abbey, or, you know, whatever it is. Sainsbury's. What? Selfridges, that one. Yes, right. And you get wrapped up in the story and the characters, and it's powerful, and you get pulled in, and there's a problem, there's a tension, and there's a resolution, and often and always there's a happy ending. And then you come out of the cinema into the daylight and you think, "Oh yeah, but that was just fiction. Here's my life. My life doesn't end like that. Doesn't seem to." When I was 16, I said that my dad died, and I grew up believing that there is just one life, no God. But when my dad died, I suddenly had these intellectual questions, particularly about suffering. If you're interested in that, come back Wednesday night. Particularly about suffering. And also this, became aware of this desire to actually know that my life means something beyond just here and now, that there could be something else, there could be something more. And to me, to be honest, God was "thou shalt not." I didn't know much about the Bible, but it seemed to me to be full of rules. You must not do this, you must not do that. And God was out to spoil my life, but I was dreadfully wrong. Those commands are sat in the middle of a story that begins once upon a time. And it really is the most beautiful story. Do you remember that word "fulfilled"? I said we'd come back to it, that word "fulfilled". That word takes us right back to the beginning of the story of the Bible. And describes that the God who gave us life is the God whose heart beats at the centre of the universe. The God who is there. And he gave us the gift of love and relationship. The ability to laugh, to breathe, to be here today. And right at the centre of all that, he made us to know him personally, intimately, to find our joy and our security in him. That is the story of the Bible. That's how it begins. People in relationship with a God who isn't in a glass box hiding behind a cloud, but is intimately involved in people's lives, people like us, who cares passionately. And in other words, people stood in the presence of greatness. But like those reckless youths on the bus, if we're honest, we don't treat God like that naturally. For 21 years, I seldom thanked God, if I'm honest. I seldom thought of him, too busy having a good time. And when things did go wrong, well, it was him I blamed. And all I really wanted from God was to give me my heart's desire, my father's life. But is that the way to treat the God of the universe? To live in his world as if he wasn't even there? To call on him when it's convenient, and the rest of the time blame him when things go wrong? Is that the way to treat the God of the universe? The Bible says that we all actually do that, perhaps in different ways, but fundamentally we do. Why is that? Well, I just want to show you this little quote here. A very candid quote, actually, from this philosopher, Thomas Nagel. And he's an atheist, and he says this. I'm sure I've got this right. There we go. "I speak from experience, being strongly subject to this fear myself." I'm talking about the fear of religion. "I want atheism to be true, and am made uneasy by the fact that some of the most intelligent and well-informed people I know are religious believers. It isn't just that I don't believe in God and naturally hope that I'm right in my belief. It's that I hope there is no God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. That's very candid, isn't it? And what the Bible does, it that resonates really with the story of the Bible. And it says if we were to peel back the layers of our hearts and our motivations and our cynicism and our unwillingness to believe, what lies right at the very core of that? What is underneath all of that? What's underneath our intellectual objection, our cultural objection to the Bible, or our personal disbelief? It's simply this, that we will not let God be God in his world and over our lives. It needs to be me at the centre of my universe. Now I know that is hard to hear, but it's the very cause of our pain and our confusion. And here's the great irony. The great irony is that without the truth of God, it's we who are lost in myths. It's we who are lost in myths. It's we who have not got our facts straight. When we say things like, life is all about your family, life is all about having one life, so enjoy it because when you're dead, you're gone. Life is just nothing, you're just a bag of DNA. You see that? The Bible says those are the myths. But the story isn't over. The story isn't over. Because astonishingly, God comes towards us, and time again, he promises to come to us and save us. Here is Jesus fulfilling that promise. Jesus said, I've come to seek and save the lost. And as we read Luke's gospel, if you were to read it, you would see that the most beautiful life that has ever been lived, the life of Jesus Christ, found its climax in his unjust and horrific death. And the Bible says that was not an accident, but a plan. And as Jesus died, what was happening was that he was actually taking the justice that we deserve. God is right to be angry with us, the way we've treated him and his world. And he's right to bring us to account. But on that day, the most incredible day of history, his justice fell on his son willingly instead. And he did it for me, Ayla Gage. And he did it for you, if you will believe it. So that we can come home to God. And God raised his son from the dead. We're going to be talking about that on Friday. So that we can come and have life. Have you ever heard of a God like that? Have you? I mean, it's quite incredible, isn't it? And he does it so that we would realise that he is no myth. So that the heart of the universe is a God overflowing with passion and mercy for people like us. To offer us forgiveness, to flood our lives with joy and hope and a certain future with him. It is the most beautiful stories of all stories. We stand in the presence of greatness. Can I just ask you two questions? I'm going to finish right now. I just want to ask you two questions as I close. The first one is, do we really want to fight with a God who is like that? Why, if we do? The second question really is an invitation. Simply want to ask you if you would take a Gospel of Luke, which I've given you already as a gift, and read the business card of Jesus and see that God has got his facts straight, and he most graciously offers even someone like me a fresh start. And if you would take that, that would be a great, great joy. So thank you so much for listening. I hope you found that stimulating. What we're going to do now, we're going to have a bit of time. Oh, Peter's going to tell us. I'm overstepping my mark, but thank you so much for listening, and do come back again.
I'm not sure if this mic's working, but let me talk nice and so you can hear. We're going to take a 10-minute break now, and that 10-minute break is for a number of reasons. It may be that you need to go to the loo, so that's an opportunity, but it's really so that you can really ask a question of the people around you. Talk to the people around you about anything that Ayla has said that you'd maybe has raised a question for you. It may be that there's something that's confusing about what he said and you'd like to just talk to the people around you about it. Raise that question. Well, that's an opportunity to do that. Sometimes we're not always very at ease at talking to the people around us about questions, particularly about faith. Well, here's a great opportunity to take that and to speak about the kind of issues that have been raised by what you've heard. So just a few minutes to talk about it, and then we'll draw it to a close after about 10 minutes. Thank you.